Chapter 15. Giordino lifted the Bell Boeing 609 executive tilt-rotor aircraft straight up into a Persian blue sky outside Cape Town, South Africa, just after 4 in the morning. Taking off like a helicopter, its twin prop rotor engines tilted at 90 degrees, the huge propellers beating the tropical air. The aircraft rose vertically until the tilt rotor was 500 feet off the ground. Then Giordino shifted the controls of the mechanical linkage that enabled both prop rotors to swing horizontal and send the aircraft into level flight. The 609 seated up to 9 passengers, but for this trip she was empty except for a bundle of survival gear strapped to the floor. Giordino had chartered the plane in Cape Town because the nearest Numa research ship was more than 1,000 miles away from the Crozet Islands. A helicopter could not have made the 2,400-mile round trip without refueling at least 4 times, and a normal multi-engine aircraft that could go the distance would have had no place to land once it reached the volcanic island. The Model 609 tilt rotor could land any place a helicopter could, and seemed the ideal craft for the job. Depending on the freakish whims of the winds, the flight should average 4 hours each way. The fuel would have to be monitored closely. Even with modified wing tanks, Giordino calculated that he would only have an extra hour and a half of flying time for the journey back to Cape Town. It wasn't enough to ensure a mentally soothing flight, but Giordino was never one to play a safe game. 30 minutes later, as he reached 12,000 feet and banked southeast over the Indian Ocean, he set the throttles at the most fuel-efficient cruise setting, watching the airspeed indicator hover at slightly under 300 miles per hour. Then he turned to the small man sitting in the co-pilot's seat. "If you have any regrets about joining this madcap venture, please be advised that it's too late to change your mind." Rudy Gunn smiled. "I'll be in enough hot water for sneaking off with you when the Admiral finds out I'm not sitting behind my desk in Washington." "What excuse did you give for disappearing for 6 days?"
"I told my office to say I flew to the Baltic Sea to check on an underwater shipwreck project Numa is surveying with Danish archaeologists."
"Is there such a project?"
"You bet your life," replied Gunn. "A fleet of Viking ships that a fisherman snagged."
Giordino passed Gunn a pair of charts. "Here, you can navigate."
"How big is St. Paul Island?"
"About 2.5 square miles." Gunn peered at Giordino through his thick glasses.
"I do pray," he said placidly, "that we're not following in the footsteps of Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan."
3 hours into the flight, they were in good shape fuel-wise after picking up a tailwind of 5 knots. The Indian Ocean slowly vanished as they entered overcast skies that came from the east, bringing rain squalls and turbulence. Giordino climbed to find smooth air and blue skies again, rising above white puffy clouds that rolled beneath them like a stormy sea. Giordino had the uncanny ability to sleep for 10 minutes, then pop awake to check his instruments and make any course alteration suggested by Gunn before dozing off again. He repeated the process more times than Gunn bothered to count, never varying the routine by more or less than a minute. Actually, there was no fear of becoming lost and missing the island. The tilt rotor carried the latest global positioning system, GPS, navigation equipment. With the GPS receiver measuring the distance to a string of satellites, the precise latitude, longitude, and altitude were calculated, and the data programmed into the aircraft computer so Gunn could determine course, speed, time, and distance to their destination. Unlike Giordino, he was an insomniac. He was also what Giordino often called him, a worrywart. Gunn couldn't have relaxed if he was lying under a palm tree on a Tahitian beach. He constantly read his watch and checked their position in between studying an aerial photo of the island. When Giordino came awake and scanned the instrument panel, Gunn tapped him on the arm.
"Don't drift off again. You should begin your descent. I make the island 40 miles dead ahead." Giordino rubbed water from a canteen on his face and eased the control column a slight inch forward. Slowly, the executive tilt rotor began to descend, thrown about as it dropped through the turbulence from inside the clouds. With nothing to see, Giordino could have simply watched the altimeter needle swing counterclockwise, but he kept his eyes fixed on the white mist swirling past the windshield. Then, suddenly, at 5,000 feet, they emerged from under the overcast and saw the ocean again for the first time in 3 hours.
"Nice work, Rudy," Giordino praised him. "St. Paul looks to be about 5 miles ahead, less than 2 degrees off to starboard. You as good as hit her right on the nose."
2 degrees, Gunn said. "I really must do better next time."
With the turbulence behind them, the wingtips stopped fluttering. Giordino eased the throttles back, the roar of the engines falling to a muffled hum.
The heavy rain had subsided, but rivulets of water still streaked across the windshield. Only now did he turn on the wipers, as he aimed the bow of the plane over the high cliffs that shielded the island from the relentless onslaught of the sea.
"Have you picked out a spot to set down?" asked Giordino, staring at the little island and its single mountain that seemed to rise up out of the sea like a giant cone. There was no obvious sign of a beach or open field. He saw only 360 degrees of steep, rock-covered slopes.
Gunn held up a magnifying glass in front of his eyes. "I've gone over every inch of this thing and have come to the conclusion that it's the worst piece of real estate I've ever seen. It's nothing but a rock pile. Good only for supporting a gravel company."
"Don't tell me we've come all this way only to turn back," Giordino said sourly.
"I didn't say we couldn't land. The only flat area on the whole island is near the base of the mountain on the west side. Looks like little more than a ledge, maybe 50 by 100 feet.
Giordino looked downright horrified. "Not even in the movies do they land helicopters on the sides of mountains."
Gunn pointed through the windshield. "There, on your left. It doesn't look as bad as I thought."
From Giordino's angle, the only level sight to be found against the mountain looked no larger than the bed of a pickup truck. His feet finessed the rudder pedals as his hands stroked the wheel on the control column, correcting his angle and rate of descent with the elevators and ailerons. He thanked heaven that he had a headwind, even if it was only 4 knots. He could see the rocks scattered across his tiny landing site, but none looked large enough to cause damage to the aircraft's undercarriage. One hand came off the column and began manipulating the levers operating the prop rotors, tilting them from horizontal to vertical until the aircraft was hovering like a helicopter. The large diameter propellers began sending small stones and dust swirling in damp clouds below the landing wheels. Giordino was flying by feel now, head turned downward, one eye on the approaching ground, the other on the sheer side of the mountain not more than 10 feet beyond the starboard wingtip. And then there was a slight bump as the tires struck the loose rock, and the tilt rotor settled like a fat goose over her unhatched eggs. He let out a great sigh and pulled back on the throttles before shutting down the engines.
"We're home," he said thankfully.
Gunn's owlish face crinkled into a smile.
"Was there ever a doubt?"
"I've got the mountain on my side. What's on yours?"
During the landing, Gunn's attention had been focused on the side of the mountain, and only now did he look out the starboard window. Not more than 4 feet from his exit door, the ledge dropped off at a steep angle for nearly 800 feet. The wingtip hung far out over empty air. The smile was gone, and his face pale when he turned back to Giordino.
"It wasn't as expansive as I thought," he murmured sheepishly.
Giordino threw off his safety harness.
"Do you have a route to the chamber figured out?"
Gunn held up the aerial photo and pointed to a small canyon leading up from the shore.
"This is the only way a hunting party could have penetrated the island and made their way up the mountain. Pitt said that according to the ship's log, the colonel and his party climbed halfway up the mountain. We're about at that level now."
What direction is the ravine?
South.
And to answer your next question, we're on the west side of the mountain. With a little luck, we won't have to hike more than 3/4 of a mile, providing we can stumble onto the ancient walkway the colonel mentioned.
Thank God for small islands, Giordino murmured. Can you detect the old road on your photo?
No, I can't see any sign of it.
They proceeded to untie the straps containing the survival gear and don their backpacks. The rain returned in sheets, so they slipped foul weather gear on over their clothes and boots. When ready, they threw open the passenger door and stepped to the rocky ground. Beyond the ledge was the sheer drop, and beyond the drop, nothing but the Indian Ocean and gray pewter waves. As a safety precaution, they tied down the aircraft to several huge boulders. The threatening sky made the island seem all the more drab and desolated. Gunn squinted through the rain and motioned for Giordino to lead, pointing in the direction he wanted to follow. They set off diagonally across the slope of the mountain, staying inside the larger rocks where the ground was flatter and firm beneath their feet. They struggled across small ledges and narrow crevices, trying to walk upright without resorting to mountain climbing gear, a skill in which neither was proficient. Giordino seemed impervious to fatigue. His thick, powerful body took the climb over the rocks in stride. Gunn had no problems either. He was wiry and far tougher than he looked. He began to fall back from the unyielding Giordino, not from weariness, but because he had to stop every 20 yards to wipe the moisture from his glasses. About midway across the west side of the mountain, Giordino came to a halt. If your reckoning is right, the stone walkway should be a short distance above or below us. Gunn sat down with his back to a smooth lava rock and peered at his photo, which had become dog-eared and soggy from the damp. Assuming the colonel took the path of least resistance from the ravine, he should have worked his way across the mountain about 100 feet below us. Giordino crouched, placed his hands on slightly bent knees, and stared down the slope. He seemed entranced for several moments before he turned back and looked Gunn full in the face.
I swear to God, I don't know how you do it.
What do you mean?
Not 30 feet below where we sit is a narrow road paved with smooth rocks.
Gunn peered over the edge. Almost within spitting distance, he saw a road, a path really, 4 feet wide, laid with stones long aged by the weather.
The path traveled in both directions, but landslides had carried much of it down the slope. In the cracks between the stones, a strange-looking plant was sprouting. It had lettuce-like heads and grew close to the ground.
It must be the road described by the British colonel, said Gunn.
What's that weird stuff growing in it? Asked Giordino.
Kerguelen cabbage. It produces a pungent oil and can be eaten as a cooked vegetable.
Now you know why the road was indistinguishable on the photo. It was hidden by cabbages.
Yes, I can see that now, said Gunn.
How did it get established on such a godforsaken island?
Probably by its pollen that was carried across the water by the wind.
Which direction do you want to follow the road?
Gunn's eyes scanned the flat-laid stones as far as he could in both directions until they were lost to view.
The colonel must have stumbled onto the road down to our right. Below that point it must have been destroyed by erosion and slides. Since it makes no sense to start at the top of the mountain and work down, the chamber must be hidden farther up the slope. So we go to the left and climb.
Stepping cautiously on the loose lava rock, they quickly reached the neatly laid stones and began ascending the road. The flat passage was a welcome relief, but landslides were another matter. They had to cross two of them, each nearly 30 or more yards wide. It was slow going. The lava rock was jagged and knife-like. One slip and their bodies would tumble down the slope, gathering momentum until they bounced over the cliffs far below into the sea. After negotiating the last hurdle, they sat and rested. Giordino idly picked a cabbage and flipped it down the hill, watching it bounce and shred on its erratic journey. He lost sight of it and did not see the splash as it shot into the water like a cannonball. Instead of lessening, the atmosphere chilled and thickened. The wind gusts strengthened and whipped the rain against their faces. Though they were protected by foul weather gear, the water found ways of seeping in and around their collars, soaking their inner clothing. Gunn passed him a thermos of coffee that had gone from steaming hot to lukewarm. Their lunch consisted of 4 granola bars. They weren't quite in the realm of miserable just yet, but they would soon enter it.
"We must be close," said Gunn, gazing through binoculars. "There is no hint of a long scar continuing across the mountain beyond that big rock just ahead."
Giordino stared at the massive boulder that protruded from the side of the slope. "The chamber better be on the other side," he grunted. "I'm not keen to be caught up here when it gets dark."
"Not to worry. We've got almost 12 hours of daylight left in this hemisphere."
"I just thought of something."
"What's that?" asked Gunn.
"We're the only 2 humans within 2,000 miles.
"That's a cheery thought."
"What if we have an accident and injure ourselves and can't fly out of here? Even if we wanted to, I wouldn't dare take off in this wind."
"Sandecker will mount a rescue mission as soon as we notify him of our status."
Gunn reached into his pocket and pulled out a Global Star satellite phone.
"He's as close as a dial tone."
"In the meantime, we'd have to subsist on these stupid cabbages."
"No, thank you."
Gunn shook his head in resignation. Giordino was a chronic complainer, and yet there was no better man to be with in a bad situation. Neither man had a sense of fear. Their only concern was the possibility of failure. "Once we enter the chamber," Gunn said loudly, his voice carrying above the wind, "we'll be out of the storm and can dry out."
Giordino needed no coaxing.
"Then let's move on," he said, rising to his feet. "I'm beginning to feel like a mop in a pail of dirty water." Without waiting for Gunn, he pushed off toward the rock about 50 yards up the ancient road. The slope steepened and became a cliff towering above them. Part of the road had fallen away, and they were forced to pick their way carefully past the rock. Once around, they encountered the entrance to the chamber under a man-made archway. The opening was smaller than they thought, about 6 feet high by 4 feet wide, the same width as the road. It yawned black and portentous from inside.
"There it is, just as the colonel described it," said Gunn.
"One of us is supposed to shout, 'Eureka!'" exclaimed Giordino, happy at last to get out of the wind and rain.
"I don't know about you, but I'm getting rid of my rain gear and backpack so I can be comfortable."
"I'm with you." Within minutes, their backpacks were removed and their foul weather gear laid out inside the tunnel for the return trip to the aircraft. They removed flashlights from their backpacks, took a final swig of coffee, and stepped deeper into the subterranean vault. The walls were smoothly carved without bumps or indentations. There was a strangeness about the place, heightened by the eerie darkness and cavernous howl of the wind from outside the entrance. They walked on, half curious, half uneasy, following the beams of their lights, wondering what they were going to find. The tunnel suddenly opened into a square chamber. Giordino tensed and his eyes hardened as his light traced out the skeletal bones of a foot, femur, hip, and then ribs and spinal column, attached to a skull with traces of red hair still visible. The remains of tattered and moldy clothing still clung to the bones.
"I wonder how this poor devil came to be here," said Gunn, feeling numbed.
Giordino swung his flashlight around the room, illuminating a small fire pit and various tools and furniture. All of them looked handmade from wood and lava rock. There were also the remains of seal hides and a pile of bones in the opposite corner. Judging from the cut of what's left of his clothes, I'd say he was a marooned sailor, a castaway on the island for God only knows how long before he died.
"Odd the colonel didn't mention him," said Gunn.
The Madras made an unscheduled stop for water after being blown far off the normal sailing track in 1779. This lost soul must have arrived later. No other ship called on the island for probably another 50 or 100 years.
I can't begin to imagine how terrible it must have been for him, alone on an ugly, rain-cold pile of volcanic rock, with no prospect of rescue and the threat of a lonely death hovering over him.
"He made a fire pit," said Giordino. "What do you think he used for wood? There's little but scrub brush on the island."
"He must have burned what brush he could scrounge."
Gunn paused, knelt on one knee, and moved his hand through the ashes until he found something. He held up what looked like the remains of a toy chariot with two badly fire-scarred horses.
"The artifacts," he said gloomily. "He must have burned the artifacts that contained wood to stay warm."
Then Gunn shined his light in Giordino's direction and saw the beginnings of a smile arc across his face.
"What do you find so funny?"
"I was just thinking," mused Giordino. "How many of those awful cabbages do you think the poor fellow must have eaten?"
"You won't know how they taste until you've tried one."
Giordino probed his beam on the walls, revealing the same type of inscriptions that he'd briefly seen in the telluride chamber. A black obsidian pedestal rose from the center of the floor where the black skull had sat until removed by the British colonel. The lights also picked out a cave-in of fallen rocks that spilled down, covering the far wall of the chamber.
"I wonder what's on the other side of this rock pile."
"Another wall?"
"Maybe, maybe not."
There was a vague certainty in Gunn's voice. Giordino had learned many years before to trust the intelligence and intuitive genius of little Rudy Gunn. He looked at him.
"You thinking there's another tunnel on the other side?"
"I am."
"Damn," Giordino hissed under his breath. "Our friends from Telluride must have gotten here first."
"What makes you think that?"
Giordino played his beam over the rockfall. "Their modus operandi. They have a fetish for blowing up tunnels."
"I don't think so. This fall looks old, very old, considering the dust that has filled in among the rocks. I'll bet my Christmas bonus that this fall occurred centuries before the colonel or the old castaway stepped in here. And neither was curious and bothered to dig through and see what was on the other side."
Then Gunn crawled up on the spread of rocks and played his light over the pile.
"This looks natural to me. Not really a heavy fall. I think we might have a chance at getting through."
"I'm not sure my testosterone is up to this."
"Shut up and dig."
Gunn, as it turned out, was right. The rock fall was not massive. Despite his grumblings, Giordino worked like a mule. By far the stronger of the two, he tackled the heavier rocks, while Gunn worked at casting aside the smaller ones. There was a ruthless determination in his movements as he picked up and heaved 100-pound rocks as if they were made of cork. In less than an hour, they had excavated a passage large enough for them to crawl beyond. Because he was the smallest, Gunn went first. He paused to shine his light inside.
"What do you see?" asked Giordino. "A short corridor leading to another chamber less than 20 feet away."
Then he squirmed through. He stood up, brushed himself off, and removed several more rocks from the opposite side so Giordino, with his broad shoulders, would have an easier passage. They hesitated for a moment, beaming their combined lights into the chamber ahead, seeing strange reflections. "I'm glad I listened to you," said Giordino as he walked slowly forward.
"I have positive vibes. I'll bet you $10 nobody beat us to it."
"Skeptic that I am, you're on." Feeling a little apprehensive now, and with a growing sense of trepidation, They stepped into the second chamber and swept their lights around the walls and floor. There were no inscriptions in here, but they froze at the astonishing sight revealed under the yellow-white beams of their flashlights, staring in almost religious awe at the 20 mummified figures that sat upright in stone chairs hewn from the rock. The two that faced the entrance sat on a raised platform. The rest were grouped to the sides in the shape of a square horseshoe.
"What is this place?" Giardino whispered, half expecting to see ghosts lurking in the shadows.
"We're in a tomb," Gunn muttered unsteadily. "Very ancient by the look of the clothing."
The mummies and the black hair on their skulls were in a remarkable state of preservation. Their facial features were perfectly intact, and their garments were complete, with red, blue, and green dyes still discernible in the fabric. The two mummies at the end sat on stone chairs elaborately carved with various species of sea life. Their finery appeared more intricately woven and colorful than the others. Copper bands with exquisite engraved designs inlaid with what Gunn recognized as gemstones of turquoise and black opal circled their foreheads. High conical caps rested on their heads. They wore long, elaborate tunics with delicate seashells mixed with polished obsidian and copper discs sewn in exotic patterns from collar to hem. All the feet were encased in tooled leather, loose-fitting boots that came halfway up the calf. The two were obviously of higher rank and importance than the others. The skeleton on the left was larger than the one on the right. Though all the mummies had worn their hair long in life, it was a matter of simple deduction to tell the males from the females. Males have more dominant mandibles and ridges above the eyes than do females. Interestingly, their headbands or crowns were the same size, as if they had equal power. All the males sat to the right hand of the central figure in a row at an angle. All were dressed similarly, but the weaving of their garments was not as elegant. The turquoise and black opal were not as prevalent. The same configuration was represented by the females who sat to the left of the more richly adorned mummy. A line of beautifully polished spears with obsidian heads reclined against one wall. At the feet of each skeleton were copper bowls with drinking cups and matching spoons. Both bowls and spoons had holes with leather thongs, as if they could be slung around the neck or shoulder, indicating that these people had always carried their individual and personalized dinnerware with them. Handsome pottery, well polished with delightful hand-painted delicate geometric designs on their surfaces, were laid out next to the stone chairs, along with large copper urns filled with withered leaves and flowers that must have been aromatic at the time the dead were interred. They looked handmade by artisans of great skill. Gunn studied the mummies closely. He was amazed at the art of mummification. It looked technically superior to that of the Egyptians.
No sign of violent deaths. They all looked like they died in their sleep. I can't believe they all came to this place to die together, alone and forgotten.
Somebody had to be alive to prop them up in the chairs, observed Giardino.
That's true.
Gunn made a sweeping motion around the chamber with one hand.
Notice that none are in quite the same position. Some have hands in the lap, others have hands on the arms of their chairs. The king and queen, or whatever their station in life, have their heads resting on one upraised hand as if contemplating their destiny.
You're going theatrical on me, Giardino muttered.
Don't you feel like Howard Carter when he first looked inside King Tut's tomb?
Howard was lucky he found something we didn't.
What's that?
Look around you. No gold, no silver. If these people were related to Tut, they must have been his poor relations. It looks as if copper was their prized metal.
I wonder when they took eternal refuge here, Gunn reflected quietly.
Better you should ask why, stated Giardino.
I'll get the camera out of my backpack so we can record this place and go home. Fooling around in sepulchral crypts upsets my delicate stomach. For the next 5 hours, while Giordino recorded every square inch of the chamber with his camera, Gunn described what he saw in accurate detail into a small tape recorder. He also catalogued every artifact in a notebook. Nothing was touched, and everything was left in its place. Their effort wasn't perhaps as scientific as a team of archaeologists might have done it, but for rank amateurs working under difficult conditions, they did a commendable job. It would be left for others, the historical experts, to solve the mysteries and identify the tomb's occupants. When they finished, it was late afternoon. After crawling back through the opening at the cave-in and entering the room with the bones of the castaway, Gunn noticed Giordino wasn't with him. He returned to where the ceiling of the tunnel had collapsed and found Giordino furiously lifting rocks back into the hole, effectively sealing it.
"What are you doing that for?" he asked.
Giordino paused to stare at him, sweat-streaked with dust running down his face. "I'm not about to give the next guy a free ticket. Whoever wants to get into the tomb next will have to work for it the same as we did." The two men made surprisingly good time on the return trip to the aircraft. Although the rain and wind had eased considerably and most of the trip was downhill, only the final 50 yards dictated a climb. They were only a short distance from the tilt rotor, negotiating a narrow ledge, when suddenly an orange column of flame blossomed and streaked up into the damp air. There was no great thunderclap or ear-splitting crack. The sound of the explosion sounded more like a firecracker exploding inside a tin can. Then, as quickly as it burst, the ball of flame blinked out, leaving a pillar of smoke spiraling toward the dark clouds. Giordino and Gunn watched helplessly and in shock as the tilt rotor burst open like a cantaloupe dropped from a great height onto a sidewalk. Debris was hurled into the air as the shattered and smoldering remains of the aircraft toppled over the ledge and crumpled down the slope, scattering a trail of metal scraps before plunging past the cliffs and splashing into the breakers that crashed against the island. The tearing grind of metal being shredded against rocks died away, and the two men stood rooted, neither talking for nearly a minute. Gunn was stricken, his eyes staring in disbelief. Giordino's reaction was just the opposite. He was mad, damned mad, his hands clenched, his face white with fury.
"Impossible," Gunn mumbled at last. "There is no boat in sight, no place for another aircraft to land. It's impossible for someone to have put a bomb in the plane and escaped without us knowing."
"The bomb was placed inside the plane before we took off from Cape Town," said Giordino, his tone like ice. "Set and timed to detonate on our return trip." Gunn stared at him blankly.
"Those hours we spent examining the crypt
saved our lives. Whoever the killers are, they didn't count on us finding anything of great interest, nor spending more than an hour or two looking around, so they set their detonator 4 hours early."
"I can't believe anyone else has seen the chamber since the castaway."
"Certainly not our friends from Telluride, or they'd have destroyed the first chamber. Somebody leaked our flight to St. Paul Island, and we showed them the way. Now it's only a matter of time before they arrive to study the inscriptions in the first chamber." Gunn's mind struggled to adjust to a new set of circumstances.
"We've got to apprise the Admiral of our predicament."
"Do it in code," Giordino suggested. "These guys are good. 10 to 1 they have a facility for listening in on satellite conversations. It's best that we let them think we're being eaten by fish on the bottom of the Indian Ocean." Gunn raised his Global Star phone and was about to dial when a thought occurred to him.
"Suppose the killers get here before the Admiral's rescue party?"
"Then we'd better practice throwing rocks, because that's the only defense we have." Almost forlornly, Gunn gazed around the rocky landscape.
"Well," he said woodenly, "at least we don't have to worry about running out of ammunition."